Thank you very much. Good morning. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to participate. This is my third year, and inevitably I learn a great deal in preparing for the presentations. They're not all as fun as the moot court we did a couple of years ago, nonetheless. I want to thank B'nai B'rith and the sponsors. And I also want to reiterate something that was said on the last panel, but from a slightly different angle, regarding the emphasis on creating powers of attorney. Before moving to Toronto, I was a synagogue rabbi for a dozen years, and there are a few things you can do for family members that are more important than providing a power of attorney that states what your wishes are, even if they're vague, but obviously you want it in the clearest way possible, but I think it's crucial. It's an unintentional but horrific cruelty when people leave family members in the position of making life and death decisions for them and don't give them guidance on how to do it. So I think that's something that that really ought to be done. The question posed, as it was put to me, is money the elephant in the room? So I don't know a whole lot about elephants. Money maybe a little bit, but yes, money is very much an issue here. If you, have the opportunity to look at the paper that I wrote that's included in the binder, I began by quoting several sources from various places across Europe, were the ones primarily that I brought, in which writers said, yes, there are issues of resources, there are issues of money, and we need to recognize that providing care for one is going to take away care from another. To quote one, economists, managers, and health policy makers think that it is wrong, even unethical, not to consider that resources are limited. If these are inefficiently allocated, they can impede other treatments with higher benefits in terms of health and life saved slash cost ratio. Yes, we have to worry about our resources. So the question then becomes, and the question put to me, what would Jewish thought have to say about the issue of rationing life-sustaining care due to cost concerns? So there's a lot of room to argue. I can stop there when I'm talking about Jewish thought. There's a lot of room to argue. But there's a lot of room to contend that Judaism would accept a rationing of life-sustaining care due to cost concerns simply because cost concerns can lead to inadequate treatment of other patients. It's not a new issue. Jewish communities faced this issue a couple of thousand years ago, not in terms of the type of care that we've been discussing this morning, but in a separate setting. Jewish communities living in the Roman Empire, obviously a decided minority and a powerless one at that, were besieged by bands of thugs who would kidnap Jews and sell them into slavery. And communities would dedicate funds for what's called in Hebrew pidyon shvuyim, redeeming captives. But they ran into trouble because when you pay a ransom for one captive, you send a message to the captors, which is, hey, we can make money doing this. And so you encourage them to do more, and you encourage them to raise the price. And the communities had to deal with the fact that they did not have infinite resources. They couldn't ransom everybody. And they couldn't create a situation in which there would be impetus for more kidnappings. And so, rabbinically, they created a policy of, we're not going to overtax the community. As I brought on the first page of my article, one may not redeem captives for more than their market value for the sake of general communal welfare. Simply because you can't. You'll destroy the community by redeeming captives for, quote, more than their market value. That's a statement from the Talmud, a principal text in the development of Jewish law. And there's more to be said on that position itself. There are limitations on that position. So, for example, if you know that someone stands to be murdered by his captors instead of being sold, then all the rules go out the window, and we do ransom, despite the cost. Nonetheless, this established a principle of rationing, which is employed in Jewish thought and in Jewish law. That's number one. Number two, when you're dealing with medical care, we do distinguish between care which is going to heal somebody, by which we mean deal with whatever illness is at hand and restore the person to normal life. It was said earlier that we're all terminal. Nonetheless, to restore the more comfortable type of terminal than the as opposed to the immediate. We distinguish between that and care which cannot do the same. So, for example, I recorded on the second page of the article, a ruling from a little over 100 years ago from a rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, who lived in Rodin, Poland, and he dealt with the question of somebody who wants to save people from a fire. And he goes into the fire and he sees that there are two victims there in the fire, one who is healthier and one who is clearly dying. And no matter what is done, even if he's taken out of the fire, we're not going to be able to prolong his life beyond getting him out of the room with the fire. And so he said, one who can save either a healthier person or a dying person from a fire, you have to choose between the two, must save the healthier person. He posed it as an obligation. And this comes up in Jewish law in modern triage situations. I brought the position of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was a major authority in Jewish law in the 20th century. He passed away in 1986. And he dealt with a case in which two patients are brought into the ER simultaneously requiring immediate use of the same resource. And he said that if doctors estimate that one patient could be healed, and the other one could only have his life briefly extended, then the doctors should give the resource to the patient they believe they are able to heal. So there is precedent for, number one, rationing, as seen in the hostage cases, and there is precedent for distinguishing between care that can provide a more prolonged benefit and care that will provide a shorter-term benefit. Having said all of that, rationing is still problematic, I believe, for three reasons. Number one, because even if care is not called full healing, such that it will be outweighed by other care, nonetheless, there's a clear imperative in Jewish law to provide aid to somebody else under what's called the duty to rescue. The duty to rescue takes various forms in Jewish tradition. I brought some of them in my paper. The most obvious and the most well-known is the biblical verse, Lo tamod al dam re'acha, you shall not stand by as the blood of your neighbor is shed. So that even if all I can do is delay the shedding of blood, nonetheless, I have an obligation to do that much. Even if I'm only going to provide temporary aid, and perhaps the best example of this is regarding the laws of Shabbat, the Sabbath. Within Jewish law, we take Shabbat, we take the Sabbath very seriously, and generally speaking, it will not be overridden for almost anything within Judaism, within Jewish law. One exception, though, is that we override Shabbat, we override the Sabbath in order to save a life. So then the question becomes, well, what if you're going to save a life, but only by moments? So they give the case Talmudically. Again, this goes back a couple of thousand years, but the modern analogs are obvious. They give the case of somebody who is in a building and the building collapses. And the people searching through the building trying to find the victims see that, yes, they could take this person out from under the debris and the person will live an extra half hour, an extra 15 minutes. But they know the person is going to die. And they know that in order to get the person out of the wreckage, they're going to have to violate the Sabbath in order to do so. The rule is you do it. We say that even temporary life, what's called in Hebrew chaye sha'ah, overrides major principles within Jewish law. So number one is that we do accord great value historically and traditionally to temporary life. Number two is a thorny issue, and that is the relationship that one has with the patient, what I call in the paper the duty of care. We have a principle within Judaism that there is a special relationship between provider and patient, and this, of course, is seen not just in Judaism, this is seen in secular law as well. As I noted in the paper, current Chief Justice McLaughlin of the Supreme Court of Canada declared in a 1992 case, the relationship of physician and patient can be conceptualized in a variety of ways. It can be viewed as a creature of contract, with the physician's failure to fulfill his or her obligations giving rise to an action for the breach of contract. It undoubtedly gives rise to a duty of care, the breach of which constitutes the tort of negligence. within Jewish law as well. We have a principle of not abandoning those we have already begun to care for. And here I refer back again to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and a position he took. We quoted him before in terms of the case of two patients who come into the ER simultaneously. Well, what about a different case? What about a case in which I have a patient who I'm currently treating, who I can only, you know, extend life for by a matter of minutes or hours, and then someone else is brought into the ER needing the same resource, and that patient could actually be cured. That patient could be given a life of many more years to come. What do I do? Do I dismiss the current patient and then take this other one? So Rabbi Feinstein ruled that no, one is not entitled to do so. As I quoted here in the paper on the third page, once he is brought into the unit for treatment, he acquires the space. Whether he pays for his time in the hospital, whether he does not pay, he's treated for free, is irrelevant. The patient has acquired the space. The patient has a right to my care as physician, and I'm not entitled to dismiss him. So, obviously that creates problems when we're dealing with rationing care within a hospital setting, because the patient's already there, the patient's already being treated, and so that's a second problem. And then you get to a third area, which I have to admit is fuzzier than the other two, but frankly, to me, is the best argument of the three that I'm going to present. And that's society's compelling interest. I think, that, first of all, the idea of society having a compelling interest that will trump case-specific need is well established, not just in Jewish tradition, but in secular law. One of my favorite examples is in the area of confidentiality, where we say that in order to preserve a legal system in which clients are going to trust their lawyers, lawyers are not allowed to divulge information other than in very limited circumstances. They're not allowed to divulge information that they receive from their client. What if that information could lead to the harm of a third party? Very serious harm. So other than very specific circumstances that are outlined by the Law Society in the rules of professional conduct, generally speaking, the lawyer is not entitled to divulge that information. Ah, but there's somebody I know who's going to get hurt. Okay, but society has a compelling interest which is going to override the needs of the individual. And we have that same principle within a Jewish law, such as in the case I mentioned before of not ransoming a hostage. The poor hostage is crying and screaming, saying, save me, right? There's somebody there who's going to get hurt. And I say, yes, but society has a compelling interest in making sure that we don't have 1,000 more people like you. And so we say, I'm sorry, but we're limited in what we can do. So there's great weight to this idea of society's compelling interest. Here, I think society has two major compelling interests that weigh in against rationing care. Number one, we want to ensure that we don't create pressure on physicians as well as patients to seize treatment when the treatment is appropriate. Because the lines in these cases are so blurry. It's not like a hostage being taken where you know exactly what the issue is. We don't have a team of commandos who can go in and get them away from the kidnappers. We don't have the ability to negotiate down the ransom. And we know exactly what they're planning on doing, so we're stuck. But in these cases, right, you can have, like the case of Mr. Rasuli, where we're saying he's in a persistent vegetative state, and then suddenly he's not. Right? Things change. Things are fuzzy. I brought in a footnote in the paper, a piece from Margaret Dory, who is a lawyer in the U.S., and she wrote an article called Preventing Abuse and Exploitation for the ABA Senior Lawyers Division. And she describes the following. She's dealing with assisted suicide. That's her her topic there. And she says, I have had two clients whose fathers signed up for the lethal dose. In the first case, one side of the family wanted the father to take the lethal dose, while the other did not. He spent the last months of his life caught in the middle and traumatized over whether or not he should kill himself. And it gets worse as you read her second case. The reality is that the lines are fuzzy in these cases, and it makes it very difficult for patients. And if we're going to institute a rationing of care, then ultimately we put the patients, their families, and the physicians in very, very difficult positions. This is not about slippery slope. I want to make sure to emphasize that. This isn't about if we permit this, then we're going to do that. This is about what do we do in the cases that we meant to address? How do we handle those cases? So that's number one in terms of compelling interest. I think society has a compelling interest in not putting its members in that position. But number two is the pressure on society to come up with better ways. We don't, in general, deal with social problems by creating an out for society. So we don't deal with homelessness by saying, okay, there's nothing we can do, we're not going to take care of them, and therefore there's no more problem with homelessness. Right? That's not an appropriate way for a society to deal with the needs of the members of the society. We find that biblically as well. The biblical text promises, it's an awkward promise, Ki lo yechdal ha'evyon mikerev ha'aretz, the pauper will never cease from the land. There will always be poverty. But the response to that is not to say, so, don't give. Or so, put a cap on your giving. Rather, the response biblically is, Ki fasarach tiftach es yadcha, so open up your hand and give, and help the people who are in need. If we solve this problem by saying, well, I'm sorry, we can't take care of them, then we remove the pressure upon society to come up with a better way. And again, this is different from a hostage case and the rationing of ransom money. Because there, they don't have the option of developing a better way. They're stuck. Whereas here, we do. I've been reading a book, a remarkable book called Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. And it describes the evolution of cancer treatment in the past century. I'm only in the first part, so I'm stuck in the 1950s. But it's remarkable even there to see what has been discovered, what's been developed, and then to think about what we read about in the headlines every day in terms of the advances that have been made. One of the reasons for those advances is because of cases like the Rasuli case. One of the reasons for those advances is because people have relatives in these situations, societies have citizens in these situations, and if we provide an out for society to say, okay, at a certain point we cut off treatment, I think we remove a very important imperative for that sort of progress. So yeah, to sum up it briefly, I think that within Jewish tradition, there is indeed a tradition for rationing resources, including for very serious needs. We do distinguish between care that will heal and care that will extend life for a limited period of time. Nonetheless, I think rationing in a case like the Rasuli case is problematic, number one, because we do have an imperative to provide some aid. Number two, because there's a prior relationship between physician and patient that actually requires that the physician continue to care, continue to provide treatment. And number three, because of society's compelling interest in making sure that they don't create these blurry line types of situations that make things very difficult for patients, families, and caregivers. And because we want this pressure on society to actually come up with better ways. Thank you.